What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Mark Yusko is the founder, CEO, and chief investment officer of Morgan Creek Capital Management. He is also the managing partner of Morgan Creek Digital Assets. Morgan Creek Capital Management was founded in 2004 and currently manages close to $2 billion in discretionary and non-discretionary assets. Prior to founding Morgan Creek, Mr. Yusko was CIO and founder of UNC Management Company, the Endowment Investment Office for the University of North Carolina, and Chapel Hill. Before that, he was Senior Investment Director for the University of Notre Dame Investment Office. Mark Yusko has been at the forefront of institutional investing throughout his career. An early investor in alternative asset classes at Notre Dame, he brought the endowment model investing to UNC, which contributed to significant performance gains for the endowment. The endowment model is the cornerstone philosophy of Morgan Creek, as is the mandate to invest in innovation. Mark Yusko received a BA with honors from the University of Notre Dame and an MBA in accounting and finance from the University of Chicago. Mark Yusko, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
No, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Excited to chat about the, and I love the title, The Matrix.
So. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. You know, ever since I got into Bitcoin, it's been kind of like leaving one matrix for another.
Yeah.
And I find that I have a lot more reality and a great tool in this matrix that I didn't have before. And, you know, I've gotten to listen to you quite a bit over the past few years, and I really enjoy hearing you speak. And I'd love to just get into, you know, all things macro investing and Bitcoin with you. But first, I'd like to start with, did you always want to go into finance?
No. In fact, just the opposite. I would say my life is just a series of happy accidents. I actually grew up wanting to be an architect of all things, and went to school at Notre Dame to do just that, but only lasted about one semester until I realized that I was an objective person, not a subjective person. And what that means is I would work all night for a couple of weeks on this project. You put it up on the wall. The professor walks in and says, just misses, B minus. I'm like, what do you mean just misses? What's wrong with it? He's like, I don't know. It just misses. I'm like, no. I need objective facts to tell me what's wrong. So I did what dad wanted me to do for a couple of years, tried engineering, didn't really like that, and then decided on advice of a girlfriend, actually, to do what I want to do, what I like. Well, I like science, so I did biology and chemistry, thought I'd go down and be a doctor, but in applying to med school, just couldn't answer that proverbial question, why do you want to be a doctor? So went to business school instead, right out of undergrad at Chicago, and then just took the first job that was offered. Went to work for an insurance company and had the first of my many happy accidents. The guy who was doing the investment portfolio retired. They said, all right, you know, you're the only guy who knows how to do spreadsheets, so take over. And it was pretty boring stuff in the sense of we were managing a bond portfolio, not real rocket science. But I did, you know, I did hire Dan Fuss before he was famous, famous Loomis Sayles portfolio manager, and another guy, Mike Brilli, who was doing this very cool structure where he was buying mobile home bonds that were backed by treasuries. So he was getting paid double digit yields, yet he had treasury risk if you actually read the 400 pages of bond indentures. So we did do some interesting stuff, but left that world a couple of years later to go to work for an equity investor. And I think, you know, we're all creations or products of where we start. You know, so I started my career a couple months before the crash in 87. So that had a formative, you know, impact on me. Secondly, and I was in the bond side, but it still had an impact. But then a couple of years later, I went to work for this asset management firm called Disciplined Investment Advisors, and it was a value investment shop. And I really deeply ingrained in me this idea of value. And then a couple of years later, get the call. You know, as some people know the story, Lou Holtz had a lifetime contract at the University of Minnesota, unless Notre Dame called, and then he'd go to Notre Dame, and he did. And I kind of had the same thing. We had $1 billion back when $1 billion was a lot of money. I loved working for the guys I worked for, two professors at Northwestern, and we were the first quant shop. We were running screens off the VAX computer at Northwestern in the evenings and selling that research and managing money. And long story short, went back to my alma mater and I learned very quickly that the endowment model of investing was really what investing was all about. And it doesn't just mean it's just for endowments, but it could be foundations or sovereign wealth funds or big pension funds, but it's a diversified approach with a value bias. And the most important thing is that it focuses on that innovation as an asset class, on overweighting things like venture capital, growth equity, and being involved in these long duration assets. Because when you have long duration capital, right, multi-generational capital, you can get paid this illiquidity premium. So that was the aha moment for me. And so it's kind of a long answer to, didn't grow up thinking I wanted to be an investor, but ended up becoming one, and really am fortunate to sit in the chairs I've sat in.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to unpack there. I really want to dig in right away, maybe to this notion of value. And if you could speak to, what is the difference between value and price?
Yes. Well, you know, my favorite line there comes from John Burbank, a good friend, a famous portfolio manager. You know, the only thing wrong, I shouldn't say wrong, but the only thing about John that I wouldn't be 100% in favor of is he's a Dukie. And since I worked at Carolina, I became pretty much a Carolina fan. So we don't like each other a couple of days a year. But other than that, we're good buddies. And he has this great line, price is a liar. And so many people think price is value and nothing could be further from the truth. And you know, the best way to think about it is like a metronome or, you know, a clock pendulum swinging. You know, how long does it stay in the precise middle? Almost no time. It's either on one extreme or the other. Mm-hmm. The same thing about price oscillating around value. And you know, the easiest way to think about it is a stock that trades on NASDAQ, right? So if you and I trade 100 shares of Amazon, whatever the price on NASDAQ is, that is the price. Because 100 shares traded, no problem, no liquidity problem. But if I have 1 million shares, I'm not getting that price. If I have 10 million shares, I'm not getting that price. And so that's the first challenge of price. Price really is a liar in the sense that it doesn't have anything to do with the value of the business. It's what mm-hmm. two people decide to exchange a small amount of that asset. And there are plenty of times, right? Let's take Amazon, right? Every year in the 21 years that Amazon's been a public company, it's had a double-digit decline in price. The average, this is an amazing stat, the average is 31%.
Right.
Five times more than 50% and twice more than 90% within a year, intra-year. Now, did the value of Amazon change 90%? Intra-year? No, but the price did. And so that is because human beings make prices, right? We make markets and human beings suffer from greed and fear. And when we're greedy, we tend to overpay for things. When we're fearful, we tend to sell things at ridiculously undervalued prices. And so again, long-winded way of saying price is just a short-term ephemeral medium of exchange value, right. Whereas the value of a business is the underlying assets and the earnings power and the discounted stream of future cash flows. But they actually are rarely the same.
Right. You know, it's very interesting. And something else I heard you speak on is that clients' training is the best training for investing. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, look, I'm glad you bring that up because I didn't plan that to be the case. Another happy accident in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of things that are good training, right? I can argue that going to school and studying philosophy is a fantastic way of preparing for life on being able to have logic and to ask questions. I'll say questions are more important than answers. I could also say that studying engineering is incredible, right? In terms of learning how to problem solve and utilize, you know, formulaic derivations to solve complex problems. I could also make a case that, you know, literature and history, particularly history, are fantastic training. And all those are true, right? But science training or science, the study of science, I believe is really appropriate for investing. Because if you think about what is a scientific method, right? The scientific method is always seeking truth, because the accepted truth at the time usually tends to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't wrong at the time. It was accepted at the time. And then a new hypothesis is formed. New data appears. We change that hypothesis based on the observation, the new data after new experiments. And investing is the same way. Investing is all about seeking truth. It's about seeking the value of something. Mm-hmm. And that is an iterative process, meaning I may think I have an idea to start Amazon. Well, I didn't have the idea. Jeff had the idea, but Jeff had this idea. I'm going to create, you know, e-commerce. What's e-commerce? Nobody knew what e-commerce was. In fact, my favorite thing is he actually moved across country from New York to Seattle, where I grew up, and crashed on a friend's couch. And he asked this friend of mine, you know, who should I pitch to? And he said, oh, I know a bunch of wealthy people. He was a broker. And long story short, his pitch literally was, you know, I'd like you to invest $50,000 unit in Amazon, and you're probably going to lose all your money. But I really think it's going to be a great thing. Jeff, you might want to work on that pitch a little bit. Fortunately, my friend did put in one of those $50,000 units, which turned into $300 million, because ultimately they defined through experimentation and iterative process how not just to sell books online or CDs online, but in essence, to create the way in which we do commerce today. But the first experiment, right, that they set up was to buy some books, put them on a website, and see if they could sell them.
Right.
And then there was an iterative process to say, oh, if that worked in books, could it work in CDs? And, you know, that clip of 60 Minutes is going around, you know, the people are trying to say, oh, look how stupid they were. No, at the time, 60 Minutes was appropriate to ask, why is this company valued at the levels it is, given that they don't make any money? And the famous quote actually from Jeff was, yeah, we lose money on every book, but we make it up on volume. And you're like, wait, math. No, that doesn't work. And he was kidding around, but the reality was through a series of scientific process, forming hypothesis, testing that hypothesis, gathering the data, seeing if it worked, they were able to iterate ultimately a business model that has become the dominant, you know, e-commerce right. platform. And I think the same thing's true of science broadly. Two things I think about. One, I'm a biology guy and a chemistry guy. And from the biology side, there are two basically states in life, growth and death. Anything that's alive, it's either growing or it's dying. And I prefer the former, don't like the latter. And so I think investing is the same way. Businesses are either growing or dying. They're being disrupted or they're doing the disruption. So I think that's one thing that I've always focused on. The second is from the chemistry side. There's something called the rate limiting factor, right? Things can only, a reaction can only occur at the rate at which the presence of one. So let's say creation of salt from Na and Cl. If there's not enough NaCl, if there's not enough Na, it doesn't matter how much Cl you have, that chemical process is only going to happen at a certain rate. So change tends to not occur overnight and instantaneously. There has to be the presence of these factors that come in and create new opportunities. So when you throw all of that together, to me, it's about forming a hypothesis, right? Something that you believe in that others don't even really understand. Mm-hmm. And that's my pinned tweet on Twitter, right? That's where the great wealth is created. The greatest wealth is always created by investing in something that you believe in before others understand. Well, how do you believe in it? Well, you believe in it because you formed a hypothesis, hopefully based on observation of other things that you've done, that iterative process of scientific method. But ultimately then, you are successful if you keep iterating, right? If you form that hypothesis, do an experiment, gather the data, reflect on that data, form a new hypothesis, iterate, change, and move on.
Right. Very interesting. Didn't you also have a very similar experience with Google and Sequoia and Michael Moritz yourself?
Yeah. So again, better lucky than good. And life is a series of happy accidents. So back in the mid-90s, Don Valentine, famous founder of Sequoia, made a decision to hire this guy, Michael Moritz, who at the time was a Wall Street Journal reporter. And I think at the time had never done a venture deal. And some of the other partners didn't take kindly to that. So the firm kind of split into two and you had a choice. And some investors went with the older partners. Some went with Don and the new guy. We fortunately at Notre Dame went with Don and Michael. And the short version of the long story is we gave them, you know, $5 million. They took about 10% of that, invested in this little company called Google, which I actually do remember at the time in the late 90s, thought, huh, okay, it's the number 21 search engine. I was pretty happy using WebCrawler and AltaVista and maybe Ask Jeeves on occasion. And I didn't really get why we needed another search engine. Good thing I wasn't in charge of investing and Michael and Don were, because they saw what Sergey and Larry were creating was not another search engine, but a whole different way, right? They had designed a whole new experiment for doing search through indexation and completely redefined search as we know it. And as we know, now it's a verb, right?
Right.
So our $500,000 turned into a couple $100 million. Right. And there should be a quad at mm-hmm. Notre Dame called the Google Quad.
Fair enough, yeah.
You know, and again, it wasn't just us. Yale did pretty well and Duke and a few others. But it was my first exposure in my career to this incredible power of innovation as an asset class, where, you know, these guys were innovating. And it wasn't big E innovation in the sense that search existed, but it was little e innovation, little e entrepreneur, in that they were building a better way to do something right. that already existed. And that historically, at least for us, has been one of the best places to make money, is not necessarily inventing something brand new where you're first out and you suffer all the slings and arrows and backlash and regulatory effect and all that, but kind of the second mover or third mover that comes and iterates again through that scientific process, making something better and then having spectacular results.
Yeah. It also seems like very early on in your career, you got very involved in identifying and managing talent. And can you speak to what maybe you've learned by finding talent and what it also means to, I guess then you're entrusting them to deliver. Can you speak about maybe, you know, managing managers?
Yeah, look, such an important insight and one of the better questions I've been asked, in the sense that, yeah, I say I have the best job in the world, right? I get paid for the last 25 years to travel around the world and talk to the smartest people in the world about investing. I mean, that is an awesome job. And I've talked to Nobel laureates. I've talked to, you know, today name brand investors like Michael Moritz and Don Valentine. And, you know, just been very fortunate. You know, had a very, very fortunate experience where Julian Robertson, famous hedge fund manager, was a mentor for many years, and been fortunate to invest in many of the offspring, the Tiger Cubs and Tiger Seeds over the years. And ultimately, it all came down to this idea of two things matter in investing. One, follow the money, right? Money tends to migrate towards good ideas. And two, follow the talent. Talent wins. You know, a mediocre idea with an incredible management team or great talent, great leadership can win, right? The best idea can be messed up with bad talent or bad management. So now a good idea or a great idea with great talent, ooh, now you're talking. But talent ultimately is the most important thing. And, you know, there are four P's that people look at when they evaluate managers or evaluate investment opportunities. You know, there's price, there's people, philosophy, and process. And unfortunately, I think most people start with price. They start with the performance or performance rather than price, mm-hmm. performance. They start with the performance of the manager. Well, performance is a symptom, right? That's like a cough. You're already sick if you're coughing. You should have avoided getting sick in the first place. So I flip it upside down. I always start with people. And if I don't find great people, It doesn't really matter to me what their philosophy and their process is. Their performance is probably not going to be that fantastic. It doesn't mean you can't get lucky, right? Bad people can have good performance. But generally speaking, talent wins. And over the years, I've been fortunate. I've been kind of in the crosshairs of a couple of talent migrations into sectors of the economy that we've been able to jump on and really prosper from. Another interesting kind of corollary to that is I say that most of my life has been spent hanging out with the bad guys. And if you're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, the people who are perceived as the bad guys, right? Because they're innovating, they're disrupting, and those people are not welcome, right? The incumbents don't like them very much. And, you know, it's like the first time we took high yield bonds to our board at Notre Dame, and the board's like, oh no, that's junk bonds. And that Michael Milken, he's a bad guy. I'm like, look, Michael may or may not, depending on how you view, may not be a good guy, bad guy, but the team that he built at Drexel, the impact that that firm has made on a global basis, the amount of capital they manage today, the people that have come out of there that have gone on to create incredible organizations, and the impact that high yield bonds have created in terms of job creation, new business formation, access to capital for smaller businesses is world changing. But at the time, it was not, you know, what people wanted to invest in. Or, you know, Barry Sternlicht, when he left JMB in Chicago and you know, people were trying to blame him for JMB's fall. I'm like, no, JMB fell because they used too much leverage in the downturn of a cycle. Barry had nothing to do with it, but you know, he came to us at Notre Dame with this idea to start this business called Starwood. And you know, after 10 minutes, I was like, not only is Barry one of the smartest people I've ever met, but this guy, Jay Sugarman, with him might even be smarter in just in terms of raw intellectual horsepower and want to back those guys. And we made a ton of money investing with those guys, and the rest is history, and Starwood's done okay. But I say that my job is really pretty simple historically. I'm just a talent scout. So my job is to identify talent. And probably the epitome of that was I got to spend an hour and a half a number of years ago with Coach K. And look, I'm a Notre Dame guy first. I'm a North Carolina fan second, but I respect Duke. And I have great admiration for Coach K. So I was really psyched to go spend time with him. And about halfway through the meeting, he says, you know, Mark, our jobs are exactly the same. And I started laughing. I'm like, okay, humor me, coach. How am I in any way, shape or form anything like maybe the greatest coach in the history of basketball? I'm flattered, but I don't see it. He says, well, let's think about it. We both try to identify talent. We both try to recruit that talent. We both have to assemble a team. We draw up a game plan. We put the team on the floor and then we sit down. Like, holy crud, I have the same job as Coach K. And he said, look, I never take a shot. You never make a direct investment, although that's changed over the years. But in my early days, I was an allocator only, right? I didn't make direct investments. Today I make direct investments. But back then he was exactly right. We had the same job. And it was that talent scout part, the ability to find talent, the ability to recruit talent onto the team, to be able to give them capital that they would take. You know, it's like Groucho Marx said, right? I've never joined a club that would take me. So if you want to give somebody money and they take it, you probably don't want to give it to them. You want to give money to people who are like, yeah, you know, I really don't need any more capital. Why would I want your capital? I got my own capital to manage. No, I want you to manage mine. So it's about that identification of talent and recruitment of talent and building teams.
Sure. My question around the identification of talent and long-term performance and maybe short-term malperformance, and maybe comparing it to Coach K and an injured player coming back from an ACL, and some injured players come back and they get back to where they were through hard work and effort, and even though they have their fits and starts, and some guys never return, or guys and girls never return to where they were. And I think, you know, at inflection points, maybe that's even harder to recognize. And since you've had a long career and gotten to see long arcs, how do you deal with, you know, short-term poor performance from a long-term high performer?
Again, really, really important. Again, most people are looking at price. They're looking at performance. and they're quick to fire, right? That first job I worked for, Discipline Investment Advisors, actually the reason I got the job originally is they had, when they started, they were the first quant shop, right? They were the first ones to use computers to screen stocks, to make investments. And they raised a bunch of money. And the reason it worked is they were value guys, and value guys were doing really, really well in the mid 80s. And then boom, the, recession in 1991 happens, value gets crushed, all their clients fire them. Okay. And then go off to hire who? The growth managers that had done well in 1991. So they hire me to try to help rebuild, their business, go out and market and help them, you know, raise some new assets. Well, what happens is growth underperformed, right? The next period, as we crushed it on the other side of the recession, just like Barry Sternlicht and others had done. And, magically, the people that had fired us in 91 came back in 95 to hire us after being with the growth guys, just in time for us to get smacked again in the next recession. And so for 10 years, they underperformed by chasing the hot dot.
Right.
So one of the things I tell people all the time, like, if you're chasing hot 3-year numbers, please stop. Just do anything else other than chase the hot 3-year number, because things are cyclical. In fact, what you want to do, to your point, is you want to invest with someone who has a fantastic track record, who just had a really cruddy year, right? You know, we all read about this guy who got smacked in the GameStop, you know, Gabe, and, you know, he's down 50%+. It was like, oh, you know, you should ever take their money back. I'm like, no, actually, I want to give him a little money. His long-term track record is spectacular. He just had a cruddy period. And you know, the data says he's going to be great in the forward and be great in the future. And again, that's something Coach K said that I took away that I think is great. It says, what separates the great players from the average players, right? The average player is the average player because they always focus on the last play, right? They miss a shot, they go back, commit a stupid foul. How many times have we seen that? Over and over and over. He said, a great player misses a shot, instant erasure, doesn't even remember taking the shot, right? Goes back, plays good defense, steals the ball, makes a layup. And that ability to just not even look at the most recent performance as an indicator of anything else other than, you know, that set of circumstances,
right?
Value was in favor, maybe growth was in favor, maybe large or small was in favor. But the reality is the long-term excellence of an organization, of a team, as long as there's no change in people, philosophy, or process, the performance or the price is just a liar.
Right. Can you talk about what Ralph is? R-A-L-F? Because yes. I got that from you, and it speaks to what you just spoke about. And I ingested that, and I teach that to my kids.
Yep. Well, look, I'm glad because now I can talk about Carolina. So Dean Smith, famous coach of Carolina, you know, sad day here around North Carolina with Roy retiring. But, you know, Dean Smith wrote this book, The Carolina Way, and in it he talks about this thing called Ralph. And Ralph is about mistakes. Look, we all make mistakes. And in fact, in investing, the best investors make way more mistakes than the worst investors. What do you mean? Well, the best investors are constantly trying new things. They're constantly pushing beyond their comfort zone. They're constantly trying to score and are occasionally going to make mistakes. But what they do is they recognize the mistake. They admit the mistake. Ooh, tough. Most people don't want to admit it. They learn from the mistake. And then the most important thing, they forget about the mistake. I mean, Michael Jordan talks about this, right? He says, I've been trusted to take the last shot thousands of times. And I missed a whole bunch of them. But then I want the ball the next time because I think I'm going to hit. Babe Ruth, right? People asked him one time, you know, you just struck out 3 times. How do you feel? He says, it's awesome. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, I'm that much closer to my next home run. And for me, it isn't about getting base hits. It's about hitting home runs and winning games. And he was pretty good at that. So the key is being able to recognize when you make a mistake, 2, having the humility to, and I think that's the most important thing in investing is lack of ego, to admit that you made the mistake, to be open to learn, right? And this might be the most important skill going forward, is the ability to unlearn and relearn in the current environment. And things are changing so fast in everything that if you can't relearn, you're going to be in big trouble. And then forget, right? To not dwell on it. And, you know, it's so interesting. If you're a bad investor, you constantly are doing the wrong things, right? You're doubling down, right? You're saying, oh, I'm right, the market's wrong. So you double down. Horrible thing to do. You should never do that, right? Just admit your mistake, cut your loss. And they would never do what you should do, which is to double up, right? And Peter Lynch talks about this, says most investors stink because they don't understand what it means to be a gardener. A gardener waters their flowers and pulls their weeds. The average investor does the opposite. They water their weeds because they want to prove that they're right, and they pull their flowers because they're afraid they're going to lose their profits. And so great investors like Julian Robertson, you know, his uncanny ability, his superpower was the ability to double up, to press his winning bets.
Right.
And again, back to basketball for a second, but Pat Connaughton, there's this great game. They're playing Kentucky, Notre Dame playing Kentucky. And, you know, Pat Connaughton, right? You look at the guy, you walk by him on the street and say, oh, you know, he's a nice guy. He's a little bit tall. You'd have no idea that he set the record for the highest vertical jump at the NBA combine, that he's still playing in the league. And when he's at Notre Dame, he's playing Kentucky, and Kentucky just pulls ahead, and everybody in the audience, everybody on TV is saying, oh, Kentucky's going to win. And he's in the huddle saying, guys, we're going to win. And people look at him like, what are you talking about? Didn't you just see what happened? No, we're going to win. We're going to win. And sure enough, gets the ball, passed the ball. I think he passed the ball. He didn't actually take the shot. Guy makes a shot. They win. And someone asked him afterwards, how did you know? He says, my dad taught me. Winners win. You have to have that positive mental attitude to win and to make it happen. So I think ultimately what Ralph is so important about is that ability to be cognizant of where you are in an investment. Is it working or is it not working? That humility to admit when you make a mistake, that openness to learn from the lessons that are being taught by the mistake, and then the ability to get back up and keep shooting and just forget that you even took the shot. So
yeah, interesting stuff. The press the winners thing really struck a chord with me when I heard you say that a couple of years ago. It really spoke to just my framework of how to look at, you know, bets. And the next thing I want to turn to is just level set a bit. And what is the endowment model of investment, investing?
You know, it's funny. It's called the endowment model. And you know, some people say, oh, you know, David Swensen invented it. And, you know, not to cast aspersions to David, he's an amazing investor and maybe one of the best ever. But really, Cambridge Associates probably coined the term. And they taught it to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Stanford and others. And David perfected it maybe and wrote the book on it. But it's not just endowments. I mean, great foundations use this, great pension funds. And not that that's an oxymoron. There are some great pension funds, but there aren't as many maybe as endowments and foundations. Mostly because of this challenge of an investment committee should be an odd number and three is too many. Right. And most big pensions have these big unwieldy boards and they make kind of mediocre decisions because they're so afraid of not being on the board. And the ones that give their CIOs latitude, you know, we work with a couple that are fantastic in that regard in Fairfax County, where they've let their CIOs really drive the bus. And that's really important because, you know, individuals make good decisions. But there are sovereign wealth funds and there are family offices and individuals. But ultimately, what is called this endowment model is really pretty simple. It is diversification keeps you rich, right? If you have multi-generational wealth, you've already gotten rich. Now, all great wealth comes from concentration, not diversification. How do you get rich? Concentrate, either in a stock position, a business, a real estate position, whatever. Now, the problem is, how do you create a small fortune? Start with a large fortune and stay concentrated. And people say, oh, I don't want to pay the taxes. Wait long enough, you won't have to. So lots of examples, people who bought Cisco early, rode it all the way up in 2000, didn't want to pay the taxes. And now 21 years later, it's still down 40%. So they didn't have to pay any taxes. So concentration creates wealth. And if you're in the wealth creation business, yeah, go for it. But if you're in the wealth preservation business, meaning you have multi-generational assets, endowments, foundations, pension funds, sovereign wealth, multi-generational families, there it's all about diversification. And diversification, Markowitz's theory, he basically said when you start with a low-risk asset like cash, which actually is the riskiest asset in the world after inflation, which is just theft. So if you start with that cash position and add bonds, which are riskier than cash, the risk of the portfolio actually goes down. Add stocks, risk goes down. Add hedge funds, risk goes down. Add venture capital, risk goes down. Now, Markowitz won the Nobel Prize for this, and it's really, really important. So diversified portfolios are at the core of this endowment model. The second thing is a value bias, meaning you want to own things that are cheap and sell things that are expensive. So in other words, that means you have an active rebalancing program. And rebalancing is just the opposite of speculating. And speculating is not evil, right? People say, oh, speculators. Well, speculators are important. They're the opposite of hedgers, right? An oil company drills oil. They need to hedge their production so they don't want to take price risk. They need speculators on the other side to buy the oil price risk. That's what makes a market, both people on either side. So speculation is not evil, but the difference in a diversified portfolio is you set a target for an asset. So let's say I have a 20% target to, you know, US large cap stocks. If I want to go to 25%, that's a speculation. I'm moving away from my target. If I'm at 25% and I rebalance back to 20, that's moving back to my target. That's a rebalancing. They're just movements away or toward your strategic target. And now you can be a tactical overweight. That's a short-term speculation, or you can be a long-term speculation if you think there's a great opportunity. So again, speculation, not a bad thing, but part of the process. The third thing is, so you have a diversified portfolio, value bias. I guess the third thing would be that discipline of rebalancing, so moving back to your strategic targets. And then the fourth thing is this overweight to the illiquidity premium, or this overweight to innovation as an asset class. If you think about, there's four ways we can make money in the world, right? If we take no risk, we get the risk-free rate, we stay in cash. Now, it's actually really risky because after inflation, you're losing money every day. But we can choose to take credit risk. We can buy a bond. A bond is a contractual claim. If you don't get paid, you can sue. So you only get 2% above risk-free. Then you can take equity risk. Equity is a contingent claim, meaning you only get paid if the bondholders get all their money back. So you get paid more, 5% above bonds, 7% above risk-free long-term. Then you can take illiquidity risk. Now, the great thing about illiquidity risk, that's just private equity, private real estate, private energy, private debt. Think about a treasury bond versus a privately negotiated loan between you and I, right? A treasury can issue at 2%. I'm going to charge you more than 2% for a private loan. And that spread is an illiquidity premium because I can't take that loan that I made to you and sell it to somebody else immediately. So private investments pay you more, which is great because if you have a long time horizon, you can do time horizon arbitrage against other investors who have a shorter time preference, individuals, you know, people who don't have multi-generational assets. So the endowments in particular took advantage of that, and they have big overweights to things like venture capital, growth equity, buyouts, you know, private energy, private debt, et cetera. And then the last way to make money is leverage. Leverage is just a tool. It works really well when it works. And as we saw a couple of weeks ago with Archegos, it doesn't work very well on the other side, and you can get liquidated and lose all your equity. Think about a house, right? If you buy a house and you put 20% down and you borrow 80%, and the price moves 10%, ooh, awesome, right? It moves up 10%. I just made 50% on my money, 10 divided by 20. But if it moves down 10%, ooh, I just lost half my equity. If it goes down 20%, I lost all my equity. Well, wait a second. Well, what if you put 100% down and the price moves down 1%? You got no equity left. So that's the interesting thing about leverage, is it's just a tool, but it can be very painful on the other side. So we really like the illiquidity premium as the primary driver of what really separates the endowment. So if you look at over the last 20 years, if you bought bonds, you made 5.5. You bought stocks, you made 7. if the average endowment made 9, but the best endowments made 11. How is that possible? Well, it's because they overweight innovation as an asset class, primarily through venture capital.
When you mentioned strategic targets, is that baked into the investment policy or is that slightly different?
No, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So every institution will have this investment policy and it will have targets and ranges for each asset class. And they differ from institution to institution, depending on the makeup of the board and the makeup of the CIO, but they're pretty relatively close. And then to your point, you're either going to rebalance back toward that target or you're going to speculate away from that target.
Right. And, you know, I guess, you know, in this current environment with Bitcoin, do you see major institutions or endowments or family offices changing their investment policy or rebalancing out of Bitcoin if we go parabolic?
Yeah, look, it is a really important question. And look, I've been on this kick for a couple of years now, hashtag get off zero, trying to convince institutions that zero strategic allocation to Bitcoin or digital assets more broadly is the wrong number. We've been successful in a couple places to get people to the 1% or 2% level. And I think the challenge is exactly as you say, now that we've seen this you know, not full parabolic, but pretty parabolic move over the last year, you know, we're up 10x in a year, and suddenly that 1% allocation is now 2 or 3%. Do you rebalance? Do you press? You know, do you do what you know, winners press winners? And I think it is a challenge. Part of it is I'm just happy that we're having the discussion because maybe 1% was the wrong strategic target to begin with. And maybe we should be doubling that or trebling that to get to a better strategic target. I can also make the case that from time to time, rebalancing is okay. You know, I guess the hodlers will not like when I say that. But at the end of the day, an institution with a multi-generational time frame has a different risk profile, and the risk of ruin, right, is very different, right? If you're an individual and you literally put most of your net worth in BTC, and it does go down a lot, which I'm not saying it will, but if it were to go down a lot, you know, your life may or may not change that much, depending on how old you are and how much money you had and other things. But an institution that has to make payments every year, you know, one of the big kind of misunderstandings about endowments in particular is it's just a big piggy bank and you can just spend it whenever you want and you don't have to spend. No. Once someone gives the corpus, you know, you give $1 million gift, I can never touch that $1 million. I can only spend what I earn above inflation because I have to preserve intergenerational equity and preserve purchasing power. So I have to have a more stable stream of future returns, which means I want to be a little more diversified to lower that volatility.
Right. If you had your choice, would you want to like bet on a great team, a great product, or a great market?
Great question. I'll always bet on the team, but to hedge that a little bit, I would like that team to be backing something that solves a problem, right? I mean, I like products that solve big problems. And so, you know, it helps to have all of those. I mean, large markets are great. You know, people talk about TAM all the time, total addressable market. And, oh, if the market's huge, that can be great. Well, let's think about that. It's like the old, if I sell one, you know, shoe to everyone in China, well, selling one shoe is a bad strategy. Or sell a toothbrush to everyone in China. Well, okay, that's great. But what's your edge for selling toothbrushes in China? So the large market isn't enough. You really do need a product that is either better or cheaper, or you know, you have the distribution to get that toothbrush to the people in China. But if you can come up with a product or service that solves somebody's problem, you know, take payments or take an addiction to gaming or gambling. Any of those things have been, you know, huge successes in China. You know, one of our best investments in China has a little bit of the, if I could just get a toothbrush to every person in China, I say all the time, or I should say my wife says, you know, that I'm frequently wrong and never in doubt. And I say, well, okay, occasionally wrong, but yeah, the never in doubt. Yes, I do speak in hyperbole. I do speak very forcefully. I speak with conviction. And that's because I think if you don't have conviction, you won't act. And if you don't act, you can't win. And but I have strong opinions loosely held, meaning I will change my mind in a heartbeat. In fact, people get all, you know, pissy on Twitter, like, oh, 3 years ago, you said this. I'm like, are you kidding me? In the last 3 years, I've changed my mind 7 times. And that's okay. I don't mind changing my mind. But back to this is, I am not sure of a lot, but I am sure. Like, I am as certain as the sun will rise tomorrow that as people get wealthier in China, they're going to eat out at restaurants more often. 100% certain of that. And so we invested in a company that was basically going to become the Sysco, S-Y-S-C-O of China. And they, you know, were creating a food delivery company because Sysco in the US is never going to be allowed to open in China because they're like national champions. So I want to invest in the national champion, which is a trucking delivery service in China. And we're going to make, you know, tens, if not 20s of times of our money for a very simple idea. But we're taking advantage of a big market, a pretty simple idea, but a good idea. But then ultimately it was the people that were able to execute that plan and get the drivers and get the trucks and get the deliveries and get the clients. Right. So really it was about execution.
I hear what you're saying. Why is the preservation of capital so important? How does it separate long-term winners from losers? And I want to tag onto that as cash holdings an investment in and of itself.
Yes. So in reverse order, cash is an investment. And we'll talk about why. It has to do with the mathematics of loss. Look, the mathematics of loss are horrible, right? The way to win in investing is to follow Roy Neuberger, founder of Neuberger Berman, one of my personal heroes. You know, he went in the office every day till he was 94, managed his own money till he was 101, finally passed 106, or maybe he was 107. But, you know, God rest his soul, he had three rules. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't lose money. Rule number three, don't forget the first two rules. And the key is that math is hard when it comes to losing. If you're down 10%, you got to be up 11. You're down 20, you got to be up 25. If you're down 50, you got to be up 100. God forbid you go down 95%, which does happen. Take Russia in 1997. I remember sitting with George Rohr, famous Russian manager. Russian stocks were down 95%, and they needed to go up 20-fold to get even. Now, if you had avoided the down 95, you had to buy. And I was sitting with him at the LaGuardia Airport, American Airlines Club, and he had a little handwritten piece of paper on a graph paper back when, you know, us old guys use graph paper. And he's like, Mark, you got to buy this. And thankfully, I put, you know, a little bit of money in my kid's college account. I bought the only listed Russian oil company at the time. Not even a lot, $1,000, but it went up 40 times because I didn't pay attention to it. And, you know, you had to buy. So if you could avoid the loss, you knew that eventually Russia was going to get back to where it was. And that 20-fold increase. The problem is for most people is they press their losses and they compound their error. And so they go down 10%. And they're like, oh, I'm right. The market's wrong. And they buy some more. Now they're down 20% and they buy some more. And now they're down 30%. Well, remember, if you're down 30%, you don't have to be up 30% to get even. Now you got to be up closer to, you know, 50% to get even. And that's a problem. And so the average investor compounds their error. So the first error was, you know, buying something that doesn't work. Okay, we all do that. We make mistakes. But the second error is to not correct the mistake quickly. And the third mistake was to double down on it. So for me, we're not ever going to avoid all losses. So following Roy's rules about not losing money, really hard. But when you do start to lose money, step to the sidelines and figure out what's wrong and find new ways to deploy capital. Keep the power compounding working on your side. In fact, you know, we just launched this in December. We launched a Bitcoin risk managed fund or a risk managed Bitcoin fund. And people say, what is that? Well, it's a fund that uses trend following strategies to truncate downside risk. So very simple idea. The CTAs have been doing it for decades up in Chicago. And the idea is you use mathematical formulas to tell you when you should just step to the sidelines. And I call it the 315 train problem, right? You're standing on the tracks at 310 and you look up and the train's right in your face. You say, you're not supposed to be here. You're right, but you're dead. So just step off the track, let the train go by, pull in the station, then step on and go on your way. Right. So you don't have to be right. You have to be alive. And by trying to prove that you're right all the time, I think investors tend to compound their losses in a bad way.
Right. I hear what you're saying on that too. What is the idea of shorting an asset?
So shorting or short selling is basically the idea that there are two sides of every trade. There's a buyer and a seller. And just like most, 90%+ of the investment business focuses on the long side, on buying. The reality is for every buy, there is a seller. Now, sometimes that seller has asymmetric information. They know better. They're selling for a reason. You know, one of the things is right now we're going through a period where there's massive insider selling, right? Lots of IPOs, lots of companies coming to market. And the insiders are unloading like we've never seen before. The only other time it was close was 2000. Now, I would say that those people know more about the company than the rest of us, right? Because they're insiders by definition. And if they're allowed to sell, which they are, we should probably listen to that. And we probably shouldn't be buying that. So I say, you know, insiders don't sell at bottoms, right? They're going to sell at tops. And I think the same thing is true of short selling, in the sense that there are going to be times when companies get to levels of valuation that don't make sense, right? This goes to the price value thing, right? Is we can come up with what we think the value of any business is, or any stream of cash flows is. And then we can look at the price of that asset, and you can determine when the price is way above that level, you might want to sell short, meaning you borrow that stock or that security, you sell it into the market with the expectation that the price will fall and you can buy it back at a lower price and make a profit. And short selling is a really good thing long-term, because it provides basically a bullshit meter for the market. When things get to stupid levels, the smartest people in the room will come in and sell those securities short and make a profit. The problem is, in the last year, we've experienced an irregularity in that we are in the supercharged QE era, the post-COVID kind of crazy, you know, money printing world. And we've seen short squeezes, meaning, you know, buyers of companies like GameStop or Hertz. I mean, look, Hertz is bankrupt. The equity of Hertz is worthless, right? The liabilities exceed the assets. The equity will be extinguished. But if more people want to buy that security in the free market before it goes to zero, they can push the price up and they can force the short sellers to cover their shorts, and bad things can happen. Same thing happened in GameStop. But at the end, the final resting place of the price will be closer to fair value. And, you know, those that bought at levels well above fair value will lose money, and those that were short will eventually make money. But the best example of that actually was the poster child for it back in 2000. And he's back in the press again with Bitcoin, but Michael Saylor, right? MicroStrategy was the darling of the short sellers because people couldn't understand how he could actually make any money with this business model. And make a long story short, stock was at $3, it went to 100. They carried all the short sellers out. Short sellers came back. And it went to 200. They carried them out again. And the short sellers came back and it went to 300 and all the way to $331 before it went to three. Right. So the short sellers were right, but most of them were dead. Right. So they had the 315 train problem. But the reality was there was a problem with the business model, and Michael got in a little trouble with the SEC and stuff. But ultimately, short sellers, by and large, not every single one, but most of them are pretty darn smart. It's a tough business to survive in, right? Because the market goes up 2 days out of three. So you got a headwind, you know, your whole life. But ultimately, they provide this wonderful mechanism for getting rid of the scammers and the, you know, the fads, the frauds, the fads, the frauds, and the phonies.
Right. I'm not sure of the specifics, but from what I've gotten some wind of is that the hedge funds might be short Bitcoin $1 billion or so.
Well, that's a little different, and let me explain why. So sure. There's no question that there are some people that believe that the price of Bitcoin is too high and they're short. But most of those shorts actually are the flip side of an arbitrage. People basically bought private shares of the Grayscale Trust, And they then, and they have to hold those shares for 6 months, and then they can sell them to retail investors. So you had to be an accredited investor to buy the private shares. You can be any investor to buy the public trust, but you have to season those shares over 6 months. So people would buy those private shares. They then short Bitcoin in the futures market to take the price risk away, right? They just want to say, okay, if there was a premium in the Grayscale Trust of 10% or 20%, I could lock in that premium for 6 months, and I hedge the Bitcoin risk by selling Bitcoin futures. So there's not as much information content in a lot of those Bitcoin short positions because they are hedges for an equal dollar amount of long GBTC trust. Now, the funky thing is that premium has inverted. So now it's negative. So anyone who were to try to put that trade on today would actually have to pay about 8 or 9% for the pleasure of doing that. So I think that trade will be less robust going forward. And if they ever approve a Bitcoin ETF, that premium would go away as well. So I think a lot of those shorts will eventually cover. They'll, you know, liquidate their trust positions, but we'll see. But futures are another interesting market, though, in the sense that anytime you can create a paper asset as opposed to the physical asset, you do run the risk of exacerbating moves, both to the upside and the downside. Think of oil. A number of years ago, right before the global financial crisis, oil went to $147. People were like, how is that possible? Well, it was because there was a small fund in Oklahoma, of all places, that was basically levering up using the futures market. And at one point, there were 4 paper barrels of oil for every physical barrel of oil. And ultimately, that doesn't work. And we know how that ended. They went out of business. Prices fell about 80% down into the 30s. And, things were ugly for a long time in the oil market. Same thing happens in gold, right? There are more paper ounces of gold than there are physical ounces of gold. And people say, oh, it's being manipulated. Damn straight it's being manipulated, because banks like JP Morgan are short paper gold, and there's not enough physical gold to go around. So they can create this artificial dampening pressure, because rising gold prices might give people the sense that inflation was a problem, and they might look at the CPI and say that doesn't make sense, which would mean the transfer payments that are tied to CPI would have to rise, and that'd be bad for the government.
Right. How do you think a Bitcoin ETF being approved would not so much affect price, but affect institutional investors?
I think it would be a massive inflow of capital, both from institutions that aren't going to buy the trust because that's where the retail players go. I think they would be willing to hold an ETF. So I think that you will see some institutions finally cross the chasm. I think that it will also take one of the questions off the table. One of the questions is, oh, the regulators still hate it and the governments are going to fight it. Well, if they approve an ETF, they're basically acknowledging that this thing is here to stay, right? And we can say there are a lot of things along the way that have told us that, right? The fact that the CME, created futures, that was a big deal. The fact that there are now options, that's a big deal. The fact that there are other derivatives, that's a big deal. An ETF will be another indicator of kind of broad institutional acceptance, and I think will trigger some additional capital to flow.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear your thoughts on GBTC as well, including the premium. I don't do technical analysis or anything. I just think about the premium in the sense that as more institutional and larger money comes to the table, I wonder if we'll see a return to a slight premium at least, because maybe those kinds of entities will prefer investing in that sort of product versus their own Bitcoin. But I do agree that the premium will probably go to zero over time. Another question I want to ask you is, how do demographics affect financial asset performance?
Yeah, great. Again, great question. So the killer Ds, as I talk about them, are demographics, debt, and deflation. And the West has a real problem, right? The West has been graying for 20 plus years. Every single day in this country, 10,000 people turn 65 for the next 17 years. Same thing in Europe. Japan's about 11 years ahead of us. And you know, you can look at Japan as an analog for Western Europe and the US in that, you know, they have very low interest rates, they have no inflation, and they have stagnant economic growth despite printing more money than God over the last 20 years. You know, we think we're good at printing money. Look at the Japanese. Their M2 money production has been spectacular. And yet it hasn't generated inflation, it hasn't generated economic growth, and it hasn't made their stock market go up. So the one difference between Western Europe and the US is our stocks haven't collapsed the same way the Japanese equity market has, which is still down here, you know, 30 some odd years later. So demographics are important because 25 to 45 year old people cause inflation. 25 to 45 year old people are not productive. They don't spend a lot. And companies basically have to borrow from their customers in the form of higher prices to train those workers. So productivity is low, inflation is high. And if you look around the world, where a lot of 25 year olds like India, you'll see high inflation. 45 to 65 year old people are incredibly productive, incredibly adept at spending. And you get a lot of economic growth and market zoom. And so it's not surprising when the boomers around the world, we're turning 45 to 65, which we have over the last, you know, 20 years. It's been a great environment for risk assets, and interest rates have fallen, disinflationary. And now, as you migrate into the next phase, 65 to 85 year old people, it turns out, are not very productive. They're perfectly nice people, but they're not very productive and they don't spend very much. Right. So when you have a lot of 65 to 85 year old people, you get pressure on interest rates. Interest rates have been falling for years in Japan, in Western Europe, in the United States. I will argue that they're going to continue to fall and that we'll see negative rates all around the world, the same way we see in Japan and Europe, and they're coming to the US eventually. And it's because the governments use entitlements to stay in power. And what's an entitlement? An entitlement is a promise you make to yourself that you don't fund and you ask your kids to pay for. Who wouldn't vote for that, right? Anyone would vote for that. So old people vote for that. And the politicians promise it and they don't fund it. And then magically it turns into a problem later when you actually have to fund the stuff. So now they're talking about going worse, right? Not only are they talking about going the wrong direction in terms of age for things like Medicare and Medicaid and making it younger to buy more votes, that's just gonna make the huge payments even worse. Like, here's the crazy thing. When I turn 62, theoretically, I get lifetime medical benefits for free from the state of North Carolina because I worked there for 7 years. There's no chance North Carolina has enough money to pay my medical benefits forever. They just don't have it. How are they going to get it? Are they going to have to tax people? Well, if no one's living here because they're moving to other places and people, you know, just decide to vote with their feet, as we're seeing in high tax states moving to low tax states where you're sitting right now, that's going to be a problem. So I think the challenge, it's a long answer for demographics, but demographics is destiny. When you have a lot of young people, you're going to have high inflation. When you have a lot of old people, you're going to have disinflation and ultimately deflation. And it's only when you have this kind of sweet spot that you have high productivity and high growth. And the only place we're really going to see that is kind of 10 years from now in the US and in China, when the echo boomers, the kids of the boomers, start to turn 45.
Right. What does inflation do to people with less to little assets?
Oh, it's just theft, right? It steals their wealth. And look, I'm pretty upfront about this. I think that's the plan, right? Since 1913 with the creation of the Fed, which one of my favorite lines about the Fed, it's neither federal nor does it have any reserves, even though it's called the Federal Reserve. It's a private institution backed by the banks. Its job is to enrich the banks and the people that own the banks, which happen to be, as Andrew Jackson said, Europe's wealthiest families and our most opulent citizens. Love that line from the 1800s. And that's why he didn't renew the second national bank charter. And now that actually wasn't a great idea because then Texas tried to issue money and companies tried to issue money and it was bad. But ultimately the Federal Reserve is worse because the Federal Reserve basically has bamboozled everyone to believe inflation is good for them. Inflation is just a tax on the poor and the middle class, right? Think about if you have a fixed income, right? Whether that's a bond fixed income or a minimum wage fixed income, if you have a fixed income and the price of goods and services rises, but your income does not, you're less well off. So why would you want prices to rise? Well, the only people that want prices to rise are the people who own things. Well, who owns things? Not poor and middle class, the wealthy, right? They own all of the real estate. They own all the stocks, right? 49% of people in this country own zero stocks, zero. They don't own stocks directly. They don't have a 401k. They don't have a pension, but they own zero stocks. It's a frightening stat. And so all of this wealth is in nominal terms, and inflation creates nominal increases in wealth. So your art goes up, your cars go up. You know, look what just happened with Beeple, right? I'll admit, I don't really like his art. Great. I do respect what he did, right? He did something every day for 13 years. I'm pretty sure, actually, I am 100% sure. I haven't brushed my teeth every day for 13 years. This guy created a piece of art every day for 13 years, put it together in one thing, 5,000 images. That's awesome. Now, I don't like his images, but that's, you know, no accounting for taste. But that going for $69 million, yeah, I got no problem with that. That is a one of a kind. It can't be replicated. Love it. And that's art, right? That is a good store of value. But that $69 million is probably the wrong number in the sense that it's only high because we're devaluing dollars. Is we think about what's happening to currencies in the Western world, because we have to print so many of them, we're devaluing them. And that's one of the reasons I like Bitcoin so much. Is it's not that I love Bitcoin or the technology, which I do. It's that I believe that the currencies in the Western world are going to depreciate, which means hard assets like gold or art or collectible cars or Bitcoin are going to rise just by the nature of their they're valued in a devalued currency.
Right. What do you think about the fixing of prices, whether it's money, interest rates, or even rent control?
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. It's always been a terrible idea, right? And people don't like this either, right? But minimum wage, dumb idea. Rent control, dumb idea. Fixing interest rates, dumb idea. Markets are better arbiters of price than anybody else. And they should be free and open. And we shouldn't have the Fed setting interest rates because, again, they're just going to enrich themselves. Shockingly, I know. We shouldn't set minimum wage prices because what does that do? Think about it. If someone's willing to do a job for $14, why should we force them to be paid $15? What if someone's willing to do it for $13? What if someone's willing to do it for $10? What if someone just says, I don't need a big house. I'm willing to live in a small apartment. What if two families say, I want to live together and I don't need as much income. I don't need opulent things. That should be the choice for that person. Right. And then the businesses should be able to maximize their profits and then reinvest those profits into the economy and let more businesses be created and more growth. But by mandating a minimum wage, we're putting certain businesses basically out of business. And what are we doing? We're creating more wealth up at the top, shockingly.
Right. You know, you also phrased something that really stuck with me, which was you called it in and out politics. And if you could kind of just elaborate on that, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it just means that I believe there is no left, there is no right, right? There's no Republican, there's no Democrat. Remember, it used to be called the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists, right? If anybody watched Hamilton. So there's no such thing as different, right? There's in and out. And when you're in, you do or say whatever it takes to stay in. Right. And when you're out, you do or say whatever it takes to get in. And I can show you lots of examples, right? Ronald Reagan, everyone thinks, oh, great president. He was a lifelong Democrat, ran as a Republican. Donald Trump, say what you will, lifelong Democrat, ran as a Republican. Okay, he did or said whatever it took to get in. When he ran as a Libertarian, or not Libertarian, third party candidate, whatever he was, he lost. When he ran as a Democrat, he lost. When he ran as a Republican, he won. He didn't believe in any of those things. He just wanted to be in. And so, look, Joe Biden, yeah, I voted for the man, but am I absolutely incensed at some of the things he's doing after what he said he was going to do? Absolutely, right? How can you say you're anti-big oil and you're anti-this, and then when you get into power, suddenly, oh, yeah, that stance on big oil, yeah, that pipeline, yeah, we're just clear. So I think it's all bought and paid for. There's a reason that the lobbying index exists, right? The companies that spend the most in lobbying do the best, shockingly. And I think it's the best you know, form of government that money can buy, and that's sad. And so for me, it's just in and out, whether you're in power or out of power.
You know, you brought up oil. How long do you think the combustible engine and oil will be with us? And I'll tack that on with, where are your thoughts on Tesla today?
Yeah, look, a couple of things. So one, I think the internal combustion engine is going to be here a long time. Not because it should be, but because it has to be, just because we don't have enough raw materials and technology to make enough batteries and storage and facilities and charging stations. So, you know, it's, I don't know, 30-year process to get to EVs, even if all of us wanted an EV tomorrow, because I will admit it makes much more sense to have centralized production of energy and then distributed storage on the platform of the vehicle rather than an internal combustion engine on every car, right? That just makes, you know, much more sense. Now, part of the challenge is, can we generate enough electricity in an environmentally friendly way? That's kind of suspect at this point. You know, there was a great thing on, I think last night maybe, where they were showing, you know, how a solar panel's made, right? It burns actually a lot of fossil fuels to actually make the solar panel. Now, at the end, net, it's still probably a good thing, but don't think it just magically appears out of fairy dust. And so lots of transition has to go through first. On Tesla, look, I've been wrong about Tesla in the sense that I don't understand how a company that probably will never make money, literally will never make money. If you back out the tax credits for selling the lobbying that produced the ability to sell tax credits. If you back that out, they don't even sniff profitability. And with the competition that's coming, you know, building cars is hard. And for everybody who wants to say it's a software company, no, it's a car company. They make cars. Me personally, I think the cars are nice. I have a problem in it that I get car sick when I'm in it. I actually haven't driven one for a long time, but anytime I ride in one, I think, you know, it must be the sudden acceleration or something. I just get car sick. But I think a lot of people love them and I think it's a good product. So, but the valuation today is cult-like. And I think my own personal opinion is we made the bubble top a few months ago. I think we're in the return to normal phase of the classic bubble pattern. And, you know, it looks like, you know, you get the bear trap at the beginning and then you get the parabolic rise, then you get the drop, then you get the return to normal, and then you get the big leg down. I think that's coming. But if they keep printing money, which I heard over the weekend that the administration is talking about trying to pass a $4.5 trillion spending package of additional fiscal and free money for people, basically UBI. Again, horrible idea. But if they do that, could the cult of Tesla go on for a while? Oh, sure. That's why I'm not sure.
You bring up the money printer, Gobert. You could not have segued me better. What do you think of the current inflation right now? And is cash still king?
Oh, I didn't answer your question about cash. Why is cash an investment? Cash is an investment because it's a choice, right? And the choice is that I hold cash to preserve my wealth so that I can buy things at cheaper prices. And if you go back in history, some of the best investors on the planet, right? They go to cash ahead of drawdowns, then they have the buying power on the other side. Now, there are some that say, no, don't use cash, use gold. That's not a bad strategy. And there are lots of examples where when stocks crash, gold goes up. Although, as we saw a year ago, gold actually went down, Bitcoin actually went down. Well, that was a little bit because last March was not a normal correction. It was a liquidation, right? We were liquidating over-leveraged accounts. And when you get a margin call, you're forced to sell what you have to sell, not what you want to sell. So gold and Bitcoin went down too. Right. Now they recovered beautifully. Well, gold kind of, but Bitcoin beautifully. But I do like cash. And I think cash is king today, along with Bitcoin and some gold and some other stores of value, because I do believe valuations are at extreme levels. I think fair value is 60%+ lower than here. I wouldn't fight the the Fed and fight the administration who wants to, you know, give away all this, this free money. But I also wouldn't be getting super long here. I think inflation is set to get pretty troubling over the summer. There's a lot of data on this that if you just look at things like the ISM rebound, it usually leads by about 18 months. Oil prices have rebounded. That's a big part of CPI. Owner's equivalent rent for the first time in a long time is starting to rise. That's 40% of CPI. So it's possible we could see some meaningful CPI prints like in the 4 or 5% range in the summer. If that happens, that will be very bad for bonds. If bonds get whacked and interest rates start to rise, that will be very troubling for growth stocks, you know, particularly things like the cult of Tesla that are, you know, they need low interest rates to justify the, you know, super high multiples. And they're not alone. There are plenty of high multiple stocks that I think are pretty vulnerable. It's interesting, if you look since the beginning of the year, the FANGs are basically flat. And yet FANG, Diamondback Energy, is up, you know, 60%+. So energy was kind of thrown out, baby with the bathwater, back to value. You know, we started buying energy in fourth quarter last year when it got to the lowest weighting in the history of the S&P. Right. And we're like, internal combustion is not going away tomorrow. Maybe it goes away in 10, 20, 30 years. I think it's closer to 30 than 10, but not tomorrow. So there's probably opportunity. And it's certainly been the case this year. And I think that will continue. I think the big FANG stocks and the big go-go growth stocks are very vulnerable here. And I think owning some cash or Bitcoin or gold will allow you to buy other assets as they go down will be a good thing.
Yeah. Who do you think saved the world in 2008? Ben Bernanke or China?
Yeah, it's not even a question, right? You know, we live in an age where we put, you know, Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell on the cover of Time and Business Week and call them the person of the year and say they're the savior. Kidding me? My friend says it best. I remember a time when I didn't know the names of central bankers. I long for those days to return. So the idea that Ben Bernanke, you know, saved the world is silly. China saved the world. China printed $4 trillion. $4 trillion. And put it into the global economy, particularly through the metals market and the oil market. You know, I can point to the day, right? Oil troughed at $26 on February 10th. And, you know, Chinese futures buying in the oil markets in the first quarter skyrocketed up about 10x. And oil prices started to recover, economic growth started to recover, and it really, in my mind, had very, now I'm not saying that Ben Bernanke did anything wrong. I don't think he bungled anything. And the story goes that, you know, he was in the war room and he said to his gang, look, I've looked into the abyss and we're not going there. And we're going to pull out this, you know, playbook from the 1930s, which, by the way, he didn't invent, right? QE has been around since the 1930s. And, but they executed it well. And I don't deny that they did a good job. I just think today we're in a place because of that and because they didn't turn it off in 2013 like they should have, we're at a place now where, you know, we have emergency level sustenance and QE, and supposedly we have the greatest economy in the world. You know, again, if you listen to our last president, greatest economy ever, and if you talk to all the pundits on Wall Street, it's, you know, we're going to have the greatest recovery ever. Well, then why do we have the lowest interest rates and the highest liquidity other than the global financial crisis? It doesn't make sense.
Right. Another thing I'd like you to expand on maybe a little bit is, how do banks take control of your money when you deposit it there?
Ah, yeah. Again, one of the great myths, right? In that, you know, your money is your money. And it's a subtle thing, but not so subtle in a crisis. So when you put your money in a bank, you actually have an IOU. If you look at the bank balance sheet, the money shows up as their asset and they have a liability to you. So you have an IOU. The problem is you're not a senior creditor, right? If the bank goes bankrupt, right, the bondholders get paid, the depositors might not get paid. And we saw that in plenty of examples. You saw it in Cyprus, right? They did a bail-in where they basically said, oh, you thought you had a dollar, you have 25 cents. We're keeping 75. And we actually made a lot of money investing in the aftermath. There was a bank out in La Jolla, California called One West, and they went bust. Mm-hmm. And the FDIC had to step in because there is insurance. And it works as long as less than 3% of banks go bust. As long as less than 3% of banks go bust, the FDIC, right, which taxes the banks about 3% of their earnings, has enough money to bail them out. Well, One West was a little less than 3% of assets. And so Soros and Paulson and a few others, and because they could only own 24.9% each, we got to take the 0.4. And you know, turned out great because the FDIC guaranteed us a double the day we closed, and we ended up making about 7x. But the key was we bailed them out, right? We, meaning the FDIC and the other banks, and then the government bailed out the big banks, many of which probably we should have let fail. But ultimately, it's not your money, and it's okay because for most of us, we don't want to be our own bank, right? I don't want to go back to the days of the wild, wild west where I had my money in my safe, in my house. And as long as my gun was bigger than the other guy's gun who came to my property and said, hand over your money, I don't want that. If he wants to go rob the bank or rob the stagecoach, good for him. And money is an interesting thing. The closer it is to the source, the more secure it is. It's very similar to Bitcoin, right? The further it is from the source, the less safe it is. So how much money has been stolen from the Federal Reserve? $0. How about Bank of America's New York office? $0. How about Bank of America's El Paso, Texas branch? Probably not $0. How about somebody's safe at their house? A lot more than $0. How about your wallet or purse? Lots of money. So the further it is away from the source, the more risky it is. Same thing with Bitcoin. If it's on chain, never been hacked, never been stolen, no chance. Okay. If it's on your phone, yeah, you might lose it, right? So keep, you know, some of us are willing to centralize, meaning if I put my money in the bank, I do it because I know it's not my money anymore. And I'm comfortable that I have an IOU with a reputable, trustworthy institution. Now, do I like the fact that I can unbank myself and I can own Bitcoin and be sovereign and by, you know, having my asset? Yeah, but some of my asset I actually keep in CeFi, in centralized finance, like a BlockFi or a Coinbase, where I know not my keys, not my coins, and all the maxis are going to get mad at me. But yeah, I get that. But for a portion of my wealth, I'm very happy to have an institution take care of it, manage it, and I'm willing to give up daily, you know, ownership for the convenience. And you know, they have some insurance, not the same as FDIC, I know, but that's why I'm diversified in where I hold my assets as well. Sure. But you know, it was funny. I was doing an interview this morning of a guy who has created a very interesting model for enhancing our backup systems. Right now, if you have a, you know, a Ledger or a Trezor or whatever, you have a paper backup. It's not waterproof. It's not, you know, it can be shredded. It can burn up. And this guy had a pretty interesting idea. He's created a metal version of a backup. That's pretty dang creative. I like that, right? That's far superior to a stupid piece of paper where you write down your seed phrase. Mm-hmm. And then you got to go, oh, do I do like the Winklevine? Do I go to banks all mm-hmm. over the country and put one word right. in each place? Yeah. Yeah, you probably should if you have a lot of, I mean, they have a lot of money. I mean, a lot of Bitcoin. But for the average person, that's just too much of a hassle. And so I think CeFi has a role. DeFi, I think, will be awesome. And I think, you know, getting to that point will be amazing. And I think some of us should have a portion of that asset, you know, physical held. And there are companies like Casa HODL and others that can help you do that. But yeah, I think there's room for lots of different solutions and lots of different innovation. In the same way that, you know, one size doesn't fit all in the banking world, I don't think one size fits all in the Bitcoin world either.
Yeah, I agree. Should it be legal for young people to be able to own bonds?
one of my most controversial statements, mm-hmm. and I stick by it, right? I will argue that the 401k business was not created for us. It was created again, shockingly, I know, for the corporations who lobbied to have it happen, and happened in 1986, the Tax Act of 86, which had nothing to do with taxes. And it basically forced everybody out of defined benefit plan. So if I work for a company, I spent my life, I gave my life and my passion, and they took care of me, right? They managed my money, they were professional, they had a diversified portfolio, they got access to things like Sequoia and best in class, because they had managers, professional managers, that's what they did. But it cost a lot of money to have a defined benefit plan. So these companies came up with this idea, it was really the mutual fund companies giving them the idea, saying, hey, do a defined contribution plan, say that it's portable and it's under the control of the individual, and then put it all with us with the 401k and put it in mutual funds. Okay, well, why did they do that? Well, it immediately cut 30% off the cost of the pension. That went straight to the bottom line, straight to the management teams. The management team's like, this is great. The mutual fund companies are like, wave it in. And here's the problem. So if you're a nurse, you're working nights, you're 25 years old, you got a 401k, you go into the HR, not an investment person, you go to head of HR, and she may be a very nice lady, and she says, here are your seven options. What does the average person do? They put 1/7 in each option. They never change, they never rebalance, they never do any of the things that a long-term investor would do. And if they have five options that are stocks and two that are bonds, they're 5/7 stocks. If they have five options that are bonds and two options that are stocks, they have 5/7 bonds. That's a bad way to do asset allocation. Now, I will also argue further that, to your point, it should be against the law for someone who's 25 years old to own bonds. They can't touch the money for 50 years. For the first 40 years, it should be in venture capital, in buyouts, in growth equity, in energy, in commodities, in stocks. Should never be in GICs or bonds. Just, that's silly. Those are certificates of confiscation, particularly at these levels. And so I think we should go back to defined benefit, or at least defined contribution with a professional manager. Don't have the average person, again, that nurse working nights, he, she, they don't have time, interest, knowledge, expertise in managing money. That's not what they do. They save lives. And people who manage money for a living should want to help those people have more money to retire on and live a better life. But, you know, look, the 401k Act was really profitable for mutual fund companies. And anyway.
Yeah. What kind of wisdom do you think comes with age versus wisdom that comes versus in transience?
Ah, great questions. Look, age is really interesting in the sense that, you know, we should all strive to have a beginner's mind, right? Because when you're young, what do? You ask questions. Average four-year-old, you know, 200 questions a day or whatever the number is. And the average, you know, 40-year-old, four questions a day. So, you know, one, you ask more questions, you're more open to new ideas. But as you age, you gain experience and knowledge and wisdom. And one of the things that happened in our society over the past few decades is we kind of flipped that upside down. And the epitome of it was in 2000. There was this great commercial and it showed this table. All you could see was the feet, and it was panning, and it had wingtips and high heels and, you know, about 10 people sitting at this board table. And then you hear click, 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 someone walking, and you see a pair of red tennis shoes. And they're like, oh, hey, Mr. Chairman. That was never a good idea to have a 20-year-old in red tennis shoes be the chairman of the company. Doesn't mean they couldn't be the creative founder or the CEO, but not the chairman of the, because the collective wisdom of those people on the board is what was beneficial. In investing, wisdom is even more important, right? Because, you know, Michael Steinhardt says it best, right? Make all your mistakes when you're young, when it doesn't matter. You don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of capital, you should make all your mistakes. And you learn from those mistakes. Remember, if you recognize a mistake, admit it, learn from it, and forget it, you get better with age. And investing in particular, it's a lifelong business. The best investors I know, many of them are octogenarians at this point, some even nonagenarians. And why are they better? Because they've seen it, they've lived it. And they've made the mistakes, they've learned from those mistakes, and they get better. So, you know, wisdom comes from experience. And what's experience? It's just making mistakes and surviving. Because if you don't survive, you know, natural selection gets rid of you. But if you survive and you learn from that mistake, you get better in that, and that's wisdom.
You did say a name there that was incredibly interesting to me, Michael Steinhardt.
Yes.
I've been fortunate to meet him a couple of times, and I've been to his apartment in New York City, his estate in upstate New York. And what do you think of him as a hedge fund manager?
Look, he was one of the best ever. I mean, just incontrovertibly good. Now, he was a tough guy to work for. He was prone to some hyperbole on occasion and maybe a few bad words, but he was a great teacher. The people that worked for him who came out and did some amazing things. And he was amazing in a number of ways. You know, one of the things that I always loved was the story he told where, you know, sometimes on a Monday he would walk in and say, "All right, I sold everything." And his analyst would be like, "What do you mean?" "Well, we weren't doing as well as I would have liked to. And so I sold everything. So start over. So get rid of all your biases, get rid of, you know, I wanted to own this. Oh, you can't sell that. Just start over. Give me more good ideas." He also, you know, had this thing where, you know, he would force people to tell them the idea basically, you know, in under a minute. "Explain to me in under a minute why you have a thesis, how it's different from consensus, and why I should follow it." And then he would execute. And he was relentless in his ability to execute quickly and to take advantage of really great ideas. But you had to have conviction. And one of the things that I learned, see, one of the things I like about, again, about investing is you can learn from others as mentors, even if you don't know them personally, even if you don't spend time with them, just reading about them, learning from others who worked for them. And one of the things I took away from Steinhardt was this ability that conviction is really, you know, what gives you courage to act. And you can change your mind, but if you don't have that conviction, you'll be paralyzed and stuck. And one of the things about that is you have to have the ability to be a great investor, to make investments with imperfect information. You're never gonna get all the information. So you need to be able to act. And again, when you're wrong, fix it. Just fix the mistake and move on to the next idea, because there will always be lots of good ideas. And you know, Soros has a great line about that, with, you know, Druckenmiller repeats it. It's not whether you're right or wrong. It's how much money you make when you're right and how much money you lose when you're wrong. And, you know, the great investors are only right 58% of the time. You know, the Soros, the Steinhardts, the Robertsons, I aspire to get to 50. But it's not about right and wrong. It's about winning big when you're right and trying to mitigate your losses when you're wrong.
Interesting. I'm going to ask another two-parter. Why do governments help companies manipulate their stock prices? And what do you think the expected rate of return for stocks are over the next decade or so?
So look, governments, you know, have a vested interest, particularly today, in asset prices rising because, you know, we've transitioned to this whole 401k, defined contribution, and that's where all the retirement assets are. So there's no question they have a vested interest in the markets rising and not having a big correction, because who's going to fund those retirements? So I think what they are prone to do, and we saw this with, you know, one of the first things that Trump did with the tax cut, is you basically got a tax cut if you promised to buy back shares. And so, you know, Apple's the best example, right? Apple last year had the same revenues as they did in 2015. I'm sorry, same earnings as 2015, but their earnings per share were 20% higher because they bought back stock, because they cut corporate taxes and they used the money to buy back stock. Now, a good company, not that Apple's not a good company, but a great company would take that money and invest in new ideas and new things and new innovations and move forward. A company that has too much idle cash and not enough good ideas will buy back their own stock and financially engineer the business. Now, the fact that Buffett owned a big chunk of it, maybe that has something to do with why they chose to buy back, because that's really accretive to him at Berkshire. But ultimately, that's important in the current environment, because so many people's retirement is dependent on stocks.
And I'm also curious what you mean by, with every investment, we either get richer or wiser.
Yeah, I stole that from this guy, Bill Duhamel. Bill's great. You know, Bill grew up in a family business. They had a cable business, and he decided after doing that for a while, he wanted to get into investing, and just a really smart investor, worked for a big firm called Farallon, and then founded this firm called Route One. And as is printed on the door as you walk in, you know, with every investment, you get richer or wiser, never both. And it's because when you make an investment and you do well, you don't analyze it. You don't figure out why. You say, oh, look how smart I am. It was great. But when you lose money, you actually analyze, why did I lose money? You actually get smarter, right? You actually look at it, you analyze it, you figure out what mistakes did I make. But when you're doing well, you attribute it to you're just really smart and really good. And we're not as self-critical when we're winning, although we probably should be. We should probably be just as analytical about why are we winning? What are we doing right? Did we make good decision? Because, you know, that famous McKinsey 2x2 matrix, you know, the most dangerous thing in this world is a bad decision with a good outcome. Mm. Horribly, horribly dangerous, right? It's like when people go to Vegas and the first bet they win big and they think that they should keep betting, when the reality is the math is the longer you bet, the more you're going to lose, because right, that's the way the odds work. A good process or a good decision with a good outcome is what we all aspire to. A good process and a good decision with a bad outcome, not the end of the world. You know, clearly fatal is a bad process with a bad outcome, and that can sink a ship. But that really dangerous quadrant of bad decisions that lead to good outcomes, I think is really overlooked, because when we're successful, we don't spend the time to analyze why.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think I got that from you. Is like, the more good decisions you make, it's going to lead to more good outcomes. And you can have bad decisions that lead to good outcomes, and you could have good decisions that lead to bad outcomes, but yep, it's really trying to just increase your good decisions to increase your probability of good outcomes.
Absolutely. Like putting the odds in your favor, right?
Yeah. And I really struggle with that. If someone asks me for advice and they're like, what do you think I should do? And you know, they want to do the bad decision maybe. And it's like, I can't guarantee that won't lead to the best outcome. Yeah. But you know, if we look at what the best decision is for the most probable good outcome, this is what I would do. And you get into that rub with it. Just tell me what I want to do.
Well, and to that point, right, I'm all about probabilities beat possibilities. You know, mm-hmm. I like to do things where the probabilities are higher than the possibilities. On the other hand, you say, but Mark, what about venture capital? That's all about possibilities and all about upside, and you don't know it's going to work. I'm like, yes, in that world, in that environment, you just want to make sure you make a lot of bets. And they are bets, right? I'm betting on technology, I'm betting on people. And if you only make a couple and they go wrong, you know, you're out of luck. But the way the power law works is, if you make 10 investments, one or two are going to be amazing. You know, two or three are going to be horrible, literally zero. And a bunch are going to be eh. Right. And the eh don't really make you much money. It's the power law winners that make you a lot of money. But you have to do enough, right? You have to take enough shots that, you know, you can hit your average. And, you know, part of the problem is sequencing matters, right? If you only make three investments and they happen to be all the bad ones, you could lose a lot of money. If you happen to make three investments and they happen to be all the good ones, well, then you could think, I'm a genius and I'm never going to have a bad investment. Well, the odds will eventually catch up with you, but you just got to keep shooting, and you got to keep taking bets and making investments.
It's interesting. And it seems like you've had a really interesting dialogue with institutional investors, probably over the last 4 to 6 years now around Bitcoin. Yep. From maybe in 2015, they're telling you to stop talking about it and threatening you to leave us alone.
Oh, yeah.
And so kind of curious, you know, like, what kind of conversations are you having now? What is the value of a non-correlated asset to these large investors? What do they want to hear about Bitcoin? And how do they feel about whether they manage the Bitcoin with their own keys or not? How do they feel about an algorithm protecting their wealth?
Again, really important question. So, you know, to your point, 2014, 15, you know, they're like, just go away. I don't want to hear about it. And, you know, we'd call 100 people, 90% wouldn't even return the call. The 10 that did, 9 out of 10 would just say not interested. But that was still 1% that we kind of, you know, brought along the curve. You know, today, still about 7 out of 10 don't even call us back. But, you know, that's three times as many people as we're having conversations with, and those conversations are better. And so our hit rate with those is going up. And I think the quality of the conversation is rising because people have spent the time. Look, I've never met anybody in this business that I respect and admire that didn't start skeptical, right? I mean, this is a disruptive innovation, and any disruptive innovation should cause skepticism, because every custom begins with broken precedent, from Will Durant. Every custom begins with broken precedent, and broken precedent is very uncomfortable. Right? You're doing something new. You're doing something that, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Galileo, right? Heretic, right? Burn at the stake, the whole thing. I mean, but he was right. And I think the same thing has been true of every big innovation in the early days. They are chastised. And it's my pinned tweet, right? You know, you will be ridiculed, you know, but it will be worth it. And ultimately, the conversations we're having today have migrated from, hey, this is magic internet money used for drug deals and terrorists. And they kind of get the fact that, well, if you're a bad guy, SACO money is way better for doing bad stuff than fingers on a keyboard, full stop. So, okay, I get that. And, oh, wait, this is just technology? The aha moment for people, for me, is the same aha moment I had, right? When it hit me that blockchain was an operating system for the internet of everything, or the trust net, as I call it, it becomes much easier to understand that Bitcoin, the Bitcoin blockchain, is an application of that technology and is a way for money to evolve to the point where value over IP, or money over IP, is a substantive, transformative technological advance, the same way that COBOL and Fortran or TCP/IP or iOS DOS and Windows or iOS and Android are foundational, transformational technology advances. And so now we're having conversations about technological innovation, about disruptive technology, about investing in venture capital, about alpha, about the challenges of investing in the traditional world. So I'll give you the best example of that. So our first big institutional investor, the Fairfax Police, they're, you know, one of our leading investors. In fact, I'm recording a session with their CIO later today. And, you know, she brings me to their board meeting, and 2.5 hours into the board meeting, which is a good thing, because it means they're asking all the right questions, they're going to invest, and they made the good decision. But the chairman says to me at the end, so you're telling me I got to go tell my guys that I'm going to put their retirement in drug dealer money? Like, no. Okay, I see your point, but no, you're not going to tell them that. What you're going to tell them is, as a fiduciary challenged with, you know, looking at the world through the lens of 2% interest rates and expected returns, which was one of your questions earlier, expected returns of low double digits, maybe close to zero over the next decade, if you just do the math. We can do that math here in a second. Looking at that, the only chance we have of making our actuary assume grade of 7 is to invest in alpha. Where do you get alpha? You get alpha either from innovation or from disruptive technology or from, you know, better systems, better process, better people. And so here is a disruptive technology where we can invest in innovation through venture capital in the picks and shovels. We're not speculating on adoption. We're basically saying that as this technology evolves, we can take advantage of it. And it's worked out great. They've made a lot of money and they're happy. We're happy. But it was that vision to say, yes, my job as a fiduciary is to invest in innovation, to seek alpha, not to be afraid of disruptive changes. And maybe the big aha moment was this idea that, wait a second, equity returns over the next decade, if you think about where equity returns come from, they come from four places. They come from inflation. There's a built-in inflation amount. It comes from dividends, right? We know we get paid dividends. Mm-hmm. It comes from earnings growth in real terms. That's the amount of earnings above inflation, right, which is about 1% less than GDP growth. And then you get multiple expansion or contraction. So if we break that down, dividends today are 2%, inflation around 2%, real earnings growth, 1% less than GDP. GDP has been growing about 2, so that's 1, that's 5. So at best, you're going to get 5, but that's if multiples don't contract, if interest rates start to normalize. If interest rates, if multiples contract, that 5 could turn into 2 or 3. That's not really a good number. Right. So the idea of buying an uncorrelated asset, Bitcoin is 0% correlated to bonds, 0.15 correlated to equities, adding that in a diversified Markowitz framework to a portfolio. Look, if you put 1%, if you took all the endowments 5 years ago, that would have been $6.7 billion, would have gone into Bitcoin. And instead of making 7.2% over the last 5 years, they would have made 9.2.
Right.
That's better. Now, if it had gone to zero, which 5 years ago, some would say there was still that was still possible. I wouldn't say it's possible, but some would say it was still possible. You still would have made 7.
Right.
That's a 10-to-1 upside downside. That is the type of asymmetry along with uncorrelated nature that makes it a must have in your portfolio.
Yeah, that was the whole get off zero notion in a nutshell. You put 1% in this thing and you're putting very little of your principal at risk, even if it goes all the way to zero.
Yep.
The other 99% will get you approximately where you're looking to go if they perform. And yet that 1% will add 20 to 25 to 50 to 100% returns on that 7% or that 6.9 you're pulling in on the other 99%. And that was the argument I made to my parents, you know, for a small allocation of very little risk to take on alpha. I just got a couple more questions for you. I was curious what you think Steve Jobs or Steve Wozniak would be working on today.
Oh, fantastic. I think that's really interesting. So I think absolutely Apple would own Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And I think there would be a beautifully designed and intuitive Apple wallet. I really do. For digital assets, and they would own this market, right? Every iPhone would come with a built-in wallet. It would have high levels of encryption. It would have an elegance and simplicity to it that would drive adoption. I absolutely believe if Jobs was around, and we wouldn't have the stupid thing where the camera sticks out the back like we have now. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, he was that type of visionary who is iconoclastic enough to say, I want to go where the great innovation is, and I don't need to invent it. So he wouldn't have been first, but he would have perfected it. It's like with the MP3, right? He didn't invent MP3 players. He just perfected them. He wouldn't have invented the digital wallet. He would have perfected it.
Sure. No, I get what you're saying there. It's compelling. And I also wonder what they would be doing if they were born early, like later. And if they were coming up in today's era, what would they be messing with?
Yeah, look, I to this point, I've only seen this twice in my career where there's been a migration of talent of the best and the brightest. I mean, absolute best and the brightest. I was just hanging out in Aspen last Friday with this small group of these people that are literally, you know, an ex Navy SEAL, ex, you know, Goldman Wall Streeter, a couple other just really great backstories, and they've all found their way into crypto. And only in 95, 96 did I see this type of migration. Then it was to the internet, and you had people leaving unbelievable jobs, unbelievable opportunities to go into this crazy thing where Brian Gumbel was like, what is internet? And Krugman was saying, I'll never be more important than a fax machine. And I remember right before lockdown, a year and a half ago, I gave a talk up in New York, and this young guy comes up to me and says, hey, will you call my mom? I'm like, what? He says, you just said that the smartest people in the world were leaving, you know, traditional world to come into this space. And my mom thinks I'm an idiot because I left this big law firm to go work for a crypto. And I said, yeah, I'll call your mom. And definitely. And so had a nice conversation and said, look, you know, this is a really good thing. He's going to be great. And I think, you know, the rest of the story is yet to be written, but I think it's going to have a happy ending. But ultimately, follow the money, follow the talent. Talent wins. And it's exacerbated now because we're in a global war for talent. The best talent is recognized by everybody. Because in the old days, it was all about proximity, right? You had to be local to know who was really good. You had to see them. You had to go to breakfast at Buck's together out in Silicon Valley. Now, anyone anywhere can create anywhere around the world on any time zone and work from anywhere. And we can collaborate on Zoom or anything else. That has shrunk the world, but it also makes the very best talent more marketable and harder to get and harder to convince to work on your project. So I think it really does boil down now to follow the talent.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, do you like Twitter?
I love Twitter. I love Twitter for so many reasons. And you know, when I first entered, it was 2012, 2013. And actually our PR firm said, you got to get on Twitter. I'm like, I'm not getting on Twitter. I'm not going to take pictures of my food and tweet where I am. And they said, no, you're missing the whole point. This is, you need to, you know, get your ideas out there to attract conversation. And what I found is it's an extraordinary tool for so many things. So one, it's a micro blog. I mean, everyone should journal. And this is an easy way to do it, right? You can go back and you can see what you thought and what you said in real time. You can search it. And I don't journal, but this is my form of journaling. And I use it like a micro blog. So that's one thing that's incredibly productive because you can't hide from what you said and you can change your mind and you can modify. The second thing is the feedback you get is awesome, right? Even the trolls, right? Even the trolls have value because the more trolling you get, probably the better your idea because you're, you know, people who don't spend the time to really understand what you're talking about are going to troll you the hardest and usually means you're onto something. The other thing I love is the relationships I've built. I mean, I've met people from all over the world. I've been introduced to captains of industry, titans. I tell the story about the time I went to Greece on vacation and an hour later I was in the bank in with the CEO of the largest bank during when they were locked down, right? There were armed guards outside. And after an hour and a half, I finally said, I gotta go. I mean, the guy would have talked to me all day. And the highlight was, you know, I said, you know, what do you think about this idea? It's kind of crazy idea, but what do you think about starting a startup bank in Greece? You know, kind of like a startup tobacco company. You have no liabilities. It'd be a great way to compete, get a couple of families. He says, I thought he'd say, oh, it's stupid, right? He said, oh, that's a great idea. We'd only need about $10 million. I said, did you just say we, like you and me? And he's like, yeah, I only get paid $300,000 because we're owned by the state. I'd love to do this. And I actually know where I can get a license. My wife poo-pooed the idea, so we didn't do it. But hopefully he did, because it would have been a great idea. And just the relationships I've had, you know, I was just in San Francisco 2 weeks ago because of a relationship I formed over Twitter, and we're filming a documentary on Bitcoin that's going to be awesome. And I really like the platform and can't say enough good things about it.
My final question, are you reverse aging? Are you enjoying your wisdom and experiences more than your youth?
So the gray hair would belie the reverse aging, as my son told me the other day. So I have a unique family. So I have 31-year-old daughter, 29-year-old son, and a 10-year-old. And my wife and I had this blessing, you know, the caboose. We thought we were done, and God had a different plan. And it's awesome. And I love it. And it does keep me young and it forces me to take care of myself. But he did say the other day, he said, Dad, your hair's still black in the back. And I got a chuckle out of that. But despite the gray hair, I do feel like I'm reverse aging in the sense that in the past kind of 8 years, as I've gone down this journey into crypto and Bitcoin, I've interacted with some of the smartest young people on the planet. They keep me young. They keep me on my toes. You know, hanging out with young, motivated, hungry people is invigorating and empowering. You know, it's given me a chance to teach and kind of try to be a voice for change and innovation with, you know, my generation and be that bridge. And that's you know, that's fun. And so I'm having more fun than I've had in a long time. It's not that I've loved every day of my job. You know, that's what they say. If you find something you love, you never work a day in your life. And that's how I felt most of my career. So I've been very lucky in that regard. But I think despite I said, despite the hair to the contrary, I do feel like I'm getting younger by working on something fun that I believe in, and that I get to hang out with some just spectacular people. So I appreciate the question.
Well, I'm inspired by your vigor and your excitement and your enthusiasm. You know, it's funny. I think my kids make me feel old. I got an 8 and a 4-year-old, and I told my son some of my download numbers on the podcast and the YouTube. He said, "Pop, talk to me when you have 1 million subscribers."
Oh, I love it. I love it.
My favorite YouTubers have millions and millions of downloads and millions of subscribers, Pop. Come back to me when you're ready.
I tell you what, no, I agree with that. It's funny, on that note, my 10-year-old the other day was watching Jaden Animations. And I guess she's a YouTuber out in Phoenix, and she's got like 4 million subscribers and followers. And he's like, "Yeah, Dad, she has way more followers than you. But look, you know, she's saying what you've been saying for years." And she actually did this thing about, you know, Bitcoin, find out what it is and buy a lot of it. And it was awesome. And although I did tweet about that, saying that this was really cool to see Jaden Animations tweet about something I've been saying, until I realized she had like, you know, 40 times more followers than me.
Right, right. Yeah, it puts you in place a little bit.
It's all right.
They have a way with honesty, you know, and feedback, which I appreciate. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, Mark. I've looked forward to this for a long time. It's been great to get to know you and hear your views in this setting. So I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. Thanks for all the great questions. You know, there's nothing better than a conversation with somebody who's done the homework, has thought up some really insightful questions to drive the conversation, and really enjoyed it. I hope help you get those numbers up so our 8 and 10-year-olds can respect us a little more.
Yeah, that's something to be proud about. I really appreciate that. If you could just let everyone know where to find you.
Yep. So I'm easy. I'm at Mark Yusko, MarkYusko on Twitter. MorganCreekCap.com is our website, and a lot of fun things happen in there. And then actually the easiest way to get me is just DM on Twitter, believe it or not. I actually do respond. Although one thing, I respond to people of good character and good manners. Best advice I got when I entered Twitter was to block early and often. So I have no time for nastiness and disrespect, but you know, you want to challenge me, you want to debate me, love it. I love dialogue and debate and discourse. And I love people who ask, right? Some people say all the time, you know, how do you get a mentor? You ask. So I love people who reach out and ask. So look forward to conversations with your listeners, and look forward to doing this again sometime.
Yeah, I definitely really appreciate your willingness to engage and debate and be, you know, interactive with ideas. So I can't tell you how incredible this has been. Thank you so much, Mark.
Oh, thank you.
Mark Yusko on how price is a liar, the scientific method of investing, and innovation as an asset class, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the chat with Mark, make sure to subscribe, write a 5-star review, and share the link with your friends and family. For those of you that need to start stacking sats or want the best place to dollar cost average and get $10 of Bitcoin free on me, sign up at swanbitcoin.com/Cedric Jungelmann. Keep learning and keep stacking. This is Ced. Peace.